to HR listeners, because I was just thinking about something and lost my place. So welcome. That's a great song, by the way. It takes me to a happy place. So good morning, everybody. Brian, Nisha, and William coming to you live every day talking about HR with the people that are getting it done out there. And we definitely want to get to our guest as quickly as possible, because I think she's probably got some excellent things to share. So, Carolyn McClure, welcome back to Drive Through HR.
Thanks very much for having me again. I appreciate it.
Well, if you would, introduce yourself to our guests, and then we'll roll from there.
All right. That sounds great. Very briefly, I am the principal of Scout Rock, which provides a roadmap of strategies to empower internal ETA departments, executive talent acquisition departments, to achieve buy-in, shorten their executive search cycle times, and maximize the benefit of executive search overall. Another objective is to improve the quality of hire. So we do that through three lines of business. The first is a series of one-half-day symposia where subject matter experts and thought leaders present on topics that are relevant to ETA. Each symposium also includes at least one case study offering best practices and lessons learned. I think benchmarking in that way is often the best place to learn from other people's successes and mistakes, so that you can gain from those and avoid the mistakes of others as well. So those are always presented by other internal ETA practitioners. And then the third piece of each symposium includes an open roundtable discussion that enables a lot of benchmarking and networking and free-form discussion. The second line of business that Scout Rock has is a monthly webinar series that offers very tactical how-tos in leading an internal ETA function or, you know, executive search best practices, executive search management best practices. And I present the webinars. I try my best not to be a presenter at the symposia. The third line of business that Scout Rock has is what we call solution services, and that's sort of our junk drawer, if you will. That includes consulting, coaching, and mentoring, as well as public speaking. So that's what I'm doing now. Prior to this role, I headed up executive recruiting for a Fortune 50 company for about 8 years, and then prior to that was within retained executive search, including Korn Ferry International, who claimed at the time, and I think still claims to be the largest, but four others will dispute them on that claim. So you just never know.
Yeah, you can never, it's funny, because you can never really tell when someone says they're the largest. Is that number of offices? Is that billings? Is that, you know, number of employees? It can be cut a lot of different ways, number of clients. But Carol,
right.
Before I ask you a question, I want to draw our audience's attention to a conference that we all know and love, the HR Technology Conference in Vegas in early October. Just made their content, their agenda live, I believe it was yesterday. So take a look at that. The content is fantastic. It's a show that Brian and I absolutely love. We'll both be in attendance. This year, Steve and Bill put together just a fantastic agenda. So check that out. That's that. Enough with that.
I want to endorse it as well. That's where we had this conversation last year, was at that technology conference, and I want to endorse the conference as well. It was well worth attending.
Yeah, that was fun. I remember that Brian and I were just talking about the other day. We had a special room that we did our bid in. Let me ask you what's top of mind. Let's start there. And keeping you up at night, but you know what? Hopefully nothing's keeping you up at night. But what's occupying a lot of your brain these days?
No, it's a good question, and I wouldn't say this is necessarily keeping me up at night, but I think one of the things that I've been thinking a lot about with regards to human resources, you know, executive talent acquisition is my passion and it's my forte, if you will. And, you know, what I've been thinking about a lot lately is that we don't seem to be moving the needle very far or very quickly with regards to our executive talent acquisition practices. So, you know, there have been so many studies and everybody seems to agree that the talent acquisition function has the highest business impact of any HR function. So that's Boston Consulting Group's reference. I think it was IBM that did a study that said many CEOs say their biggest challenge to meeting their company objectives is a lack of leadership talent within their companies or, frankly, in the market. And then, you know, Bill Leasy of Ernst & Young recently, I guess not recently, but 2012, which, you know, recent is relative, I guess, wrote a white paper indicating that the study that they had done indicated that many CEOs recognize that talent is not a soft skill anymore. It has positive and quantifiable connection to a company's financial performance. So, you know, there are these data points that out there that indicate talent acquisition is important. And when you think about the impact of that executives have either negatively or positively on a company's bottom line, you think it was something that we, within our corporations and our organizations, for-profit, not-for-profit, et cetera, would pay a lot of attention to, give a lot of resources to, and, you know, make sure that we are doing it right. And it just doesn't seem that very many companies are giving it the due diligence that they need. And it is happening in a number of different ways. I think that a lot of it stems from the limitations of decisions made by the CHROs. And, you know, let me first apologize. I expect that there are several CHROs listening to this call or who will listen to this call. But not speaking about any one person or any one company in particular, but I think that CHROs are making some strategic mistakes when they're approaching their ETA initiatives. The first, I think, is that they typically house ETA within talent acquisition, so the staff recruiting piece, which is typically transactional, rather than within the talent management function, which is typically more strategic. And when I think about executive talent acquisition, in both in terms of the intent and the objectives and the processes, it's very much more of a strategic relational type of activity than it is a transactional activity. And so I believe that it should be housed within talent management rather than within talent acquisition. So I think that's a big mistake that many CHROs are making. I think, you know, similarly, I think that many ETA functions, if companies do have them, don't have the access to the strategic talent management information. So they may not necessarily know where the, you know, the down the stream succession gaps are. They don't know where the development limitations are for the executives that they have on their high potential list. They limit their succession planning only to the individuals on the high potential lists. So I think that, you know, again, I feel like you could write a book on what's broken in talent management within corporate America and maybe, you know, globally these days, but, you know, those are some challenges that I see. I think another is that CHROs are assigning executive talent acquisition leaders who have limited experience as true executive talent specialists. So I often see, again, that, you know, staff recruiters, very good staff recruiters, are getting promoted into this ETA function, or very strong human resources individuals are getting promoted into this function. And I sort of liken that to, you know, I can swim, and I can swim really well, but I'm not going to be able to swim very well against Michael Phelps. And so when you think about the kinds of people that ETA folks are recruiting, the kinds of clients that they're working with on a day-to-day basis, they need to be able to swim with the Michael Phelps of the world, if you will. And if they don't have that training, if they don't have that experience in working within that swimming pool, I guess, then I think that they're doing the company a disservice. I think that they're often setting up the person that they put into that role, setting that person up for a limited amount of success, if not failure. So those are, again, those are some of the thoughts that I have just in terms of the CHRO limitations. I think that the folks that head up executive talent acquisition themselves have some limitations, but before I sort of ramble on, let me pause and see if you guys have any thoughts or questions on where I've been.
Well, you know, what's interesting is I think most of the people listening to this call would have probably never even thought the thought. You know, from a perspective, they would probably say prior to onboarding is the world of talent acquisition, and whether or not that's the office manager or someone that's frontline or back office or someone that's a VP or above, it needs to be handled over here. Those are the people that have the core competencies, et cetera, et cetera. But what you're bringing up is really fascinating because you're saying with this particular group of people, there's a component that it is attached to succession and performance and internal mobility, all of these other things that happen inside the company, that where you can have a talent pool inside the company that you should pluck from, and also that group can, you know, if doing their job, they can go outside just as the folks in talent acquisition would as well. It's just a function of where do they sit inside of the organization. How did we get there? So first of all, giving the audience, kind of bringing them up to speed, like this is actually what goes on in probably some of the larger companies in America, et cetera. Okay, so now you know. How did we get here? And do you have some examples? And I don't mean for you to, like, tell me company names or anything like that, but do you see companies making this move to moving the ETA function inside of talent management? Do you see that that's the future of great executive kind of mobility, really, executive, the approach on how we're going to treat the executive function with our companies? Do you see that that's the path?
Yeah, really fantastic question. Whereas I asserted that I think ETA should be housed within talent management, I don't believe necessarily that the folks who have typically been within talent management are the people who should be running executive talent acquisition. My experience often of individuals within talent management is that they're fantastic at strategy, they're fantastic at theory. Many of them have PhDs in OD or industrial psychology or something like that, and their training, I think, is really valuable. But I do think that the best background for somebody heading up an executive talent acquisition function is somebody who's come out of retained executive search. So they have that in their background rather than a talent acquisition or a talent management background. So somebody coming in from the search firm side, if you will. So, you know, with laying that groundwork, your question was, you know, how did we get here where talent ETA is housed typically within talent acquisition and staffing rather than talent management? I think, first of all, it has a lot to do with the nomenclature. You think talent acquisition, staff level recruiting, executive level recruiting, gosh, it makes sense that they should, you know, go into the same bucket, if you will, or into the same stovepipe, if you will, just by nomenclature. But I think another reason why we are where we are is because of the maturity cycle of ETA functions. Most of them start off by looking at their balance sheet, if you will, and realizing, oh my gosh, we've spent so much of our budget on executive search firms, and, you know, we haven't gotten necessarily the value for our dollar, if you will. Let's see if we can't put some process and some rigor around this. And so they may decide to have an internal liaison who's responsible for helping select the search firm so that they improve the type of search firms that they're, or the, you know, the consultants that they're working with, and then also manage the search firms internally as they work with the company. So that's often where it starts, is, you know, how do we manage our search firms better? And it's all about the external process. Search firms are bringing in the external people. So that's kind of where it starts. And then often what happens is, you know, you continue to look at the balance sheet and say, yes, we're doing better, but look, we spent $3 million last year on search firm fees. $3 million is, you know, at least, you know, three executive recruiters, fringe benefits, and all the operational costs that you need to manage their function. And so you think of, okay, you've got, you know, $3 million in search firm fees versus three FTEs and managing the process internally, and all of a sudden companies start realizing that it might be more cost-effective to bring the function in-house. So again, it already started out as an external process, so they bring it in and within the organization that has an external rather than an internal process. And then typically what happens is those internal functions typically begin their recruiting at the mid-level management rather than at senior-level management. And so as the internal organization matures, they gain a better reputation, they gain some more experience, if you will, or they staff it with different kinds of people than, you know, they staff it with retained people eventually rather than with the folks that they had initially in the role. This function becomes more sophisticated and begins to be able to be, therefore, much more strategic. So they start focusing on the more senior-level work and start outsourcing the more mid-level management work. So it's a gradual process where the functions, I think, become ready and capable of being strategic and having a significant impact on the succession planning and overall talent management function of a company. So that's just my two cents of why we are where we are. And I do see companies starting to move the ETA function over into the talent management function. And they typically have been the companies that have long-standing, high-performing, very mature, true executive search functions internally. And so I think that's just a natural step. Maybe not natural. I think it makes sense naturally, but I think it's difficult to manage internally to sort of make that transition, moving the function from staff recruiting into talent management.
Nice. Hey, Carolyn, we're going to do a quick reset. Everybody listening to Drive Through HR, Brian and William, talking with Caroline McClure, and let's change it up a little bit. So in all your experience, how do you end up, two parts of the question. So how do you manage, especially on an executive level, some of the internal kind of client politics and maybe industry politics? Part one of the question. Part two, give us from your past, maybe share if you want, one crazy story of kind of what went right and what went wrong.
Yeah, you know, that's the $64 million question, and I think that having to attend to the internal politics is something that the internal executive talent acquisition teams have to contend with much more than search firms do, because they're behind the curtain, if you will, and they sort of see and know what's going on through word of mouth, through the human resources, or they see the power play dynamics in the meetings, or, it's just much more visible to you inside than it is if you're in a search firm. I can say that because I've been on both sides of the desk, if you will. How do you manage it? You manage it very, very, very carefully. Because it's your own reputation, and, you know, most of the time you are an individual who is more junior than your clients, who are the folks that are involved in the politics and the power games, if you will. And yet if you don't figure out how to get everybody on the same page with regards to the hiring process, with regards to the background, the position description, the organizational structure, et cetera, this individual that you're going to bring on board, you're going to end up doing the search at least twice within a relatively short period of time, because anybody coming into a highly politicized environment where everybody's not on the same page about the roles, responsibilities, org structure, you know, definition of success, et cetera, you're just setting up your placement for success. So, yeah, you do have to manage it. And I would argue that as an internal recruiter, you don't even start a search until it's very clear to you that everybody's on the same page and everybody agrees. And there are times when, you know, my experience is that the folks in human resources, even oftentimes the folks who are very senior within human resources are quite happy to let you as a search consultant figure out how to smooth over the politics, if you will. And, you know, that's been my experience. I don't know if that's the experience of other practitioners in other companies. And I don't know if it's because I had a team of people that could do it and were very good at it, or if it was just nobody else wanted to deal with it and sort of, you know, it fell into our bucket. I don't know. But I think, you know, I often think of it as the person's role is one of a mediator and finding ways to encourage all stakeholders to understand what is best for the corporation overall, then, rather than what is best for them or their particular functions or organizations. And, you know, once you agree, once you get to that point of agreement on what is best for the corporation, what is most likely to drive success for the corporation, then it's a lot easier to use that as the foundation for structuring and managing the individuals to the right decision. And so one crazy story to offer you was an experience that I had. There were two senior vice presidents within the company that I worked for who agreed that they needed a vice president. So the senior vice presidents were report to CEO level people. So within a Fortune 50 company, they're not drinking violets by any stretch of anybody's imagination, and they're not they're powerful people. And they're people with huge responsibilities and very visible roles. So there's an agreement. Their functions overlap somewhat. There's an agreement they needed a certain kind of a person to execute on a certain kind of a role. However, each one of those senior vice presidents believed that that new person should report to him. And so I received the search assignment from the senior vice president of human resources, and I was completely initially oblivious to the fact that there is this tension between these two senior vice presidents about to whom the position should report and exactly, you know, the nitty-gritty details, roles and responsibilities of the person coming on board. And I always have, and I encourage anybody to have what we call a search intake meeting, where you, or a series of meetings where you sit down on a face-to-face basis individually with each one of the stakeholders to gain an understanding of their perspective of the position description and all aspects of it. And it's when I started these meetings that I realized that there was some discrepancy in terms of understanding of the spec. It took me a year to get these two senior level executives on the same page before I started working this search at all, before I made a single phone call, before I looked at a single resume. It took me a year to finally get these two gentlemen to agree to whom the position should report and, you know, what the role should look like. So, it, you know, I don't think I would have been able to manage that had I been new in my role, had I been a new executive recruiter, had I not had a true executive recruiting background where, you know, dealing with politics and, you know, high-powered people on a relatively consistent basis was, you know, part of my background and part of my norm. I don't think I would have been able to do it had I been new at Lockheed Martin. I think I ended up being successful on it because I'd been there for 5 or 6 years at that point. I had earned a reputation, and I had learned where the secret levers were inside of the company, if you will, in order to, and knew when to pull and push them to, you know, achieve what needed to be done. But it seems like a crazy story, but it's not an unusual story by any stretch of the imagination. So it gets complicated, and it can be really muddy, really, really messy, and really fun at the same time.
Nice. You know, for most of the audience, they've probably never recruited an executive. You know, the difference between a director of marketing and a CMO for a large company is a vast difference, right? And so if you can, we've got about 5 minutes left in the show. Take us into what you see are some of the differences in the world of executive of search. Like, what is it really like to recruit an A player? One of the things I want to kind of get to is there any difference between, you know, A players that are women or A players that happen to be men? Do you see any differences in how you recruit or one should go about recruiting them, or similarities, if you will?
You know, I wouldn't say that it's a good question. I haven't thought of that before, but I would say that I personally don't have a different and haven't used a different approach to recruiting executive men versus executive women. I do think that there are traditional and often stereotypical style differences between men and women, but in the end, you're looking for people, regardless of their race, gender, you know, sexual orientation, whatever it is, age, you're looking for people that can do the job and do the job in a constructive way. So somebody who can achieve results but leave a whole bunch of bodies in their wake is not the kind of folks that you want to be recruiting, either male or female, into an executive level position. So you're looking for somebody who has not only the technical competencies, but who also has a slew of positive leadership capabilities as well. And looking for those and interviewing for those in men or women, I don't think there's any difference in that. I think one of the biggest differences between an executive recruiter and others, and I often find it difficult to differentiate between the two without sort of sounding like a snob, if you will. There are many, many below executive recruiters out there who have skills and competencies that far exceed mine, and in many ways and far exceed those of folks who've been practicing executive talent acquisition. But they're different skill sets, if you will. And so I may not be able to find, you know, a janitor with a TSSCI full scope poly, if you will, or a really good, I know I can't find, I'm no good at recruiting administrative people, whereas a staff recruiter is probably really good at that. So, you know, there's competencies that each team, each different group has that, you know, maybe the others may not have. So I just sort of want to put that on the outset. But one of the biggest requirements, the two biggest requirements for executive recruiters is, one is they have to have a significant amount of acumen, and I mean business acumen, I mean market acumen, and I mean company acumen. And so business acumen is sort of the nuts and bolts from a real financial perspective, how a company works and how it runs, and, you know, the company acumen has to do with, you know, what are the products and the services of the company, who are the leaders within the company, both explicit and not, who what is the market environment that company exists in, and then not only that, what is the market environment from in which the companies from which you're recruiting reside. And so it's a wealth of knowledge that you develop after many years of being in the role. I actually, a couple of years ago, saw a blog or a series of comments on, you know, when are you an experienced executive recruiter? And there were a number of comments in there that, you know, somebody said, I have 30 years of experience as an executive recruiter, and I don't think I've made it yet. I don't think I've arrived yet. And somebody else said, I have 10. Somebody else, I had 15. Others were 20. And they all say they learn something every day. So it's a role where there's an accumulative and a generative knowledge development. So it takes a certain kind of person to be interested in that kind of knowledge and to absorb that kind of knowledge overall.
Nice. Well, listen, we are out of time, Carolyn. I'll tell you what, it is always awesome to talk to you. I always learn something. And thanks, everyone, to listening to Drive Through HR today. Carolyn, thanks for your time. And everyone have a wonderful afternoon. And we're out.